McGill Daily of the Daily.
I'm McGill Daily.
Hi, I'm calling from the McGill Daily. Can I ask you some questions?
Is anyone using this
a little bit problematic?
News.
Are you designed? Could I see you for a second?
We're going to cap this. Discussion.
News, can you dummy?
Did that story come in yet?
Editorial's in 5 minutes.
McGill Daily.
You're listening to Unfit to Print, a McGill Daily and CKUT News collaboration. I'm your host, Anya Sivajothi. Unfit to Print is a student-produced bi-weekly show that brings the latest of McGill and Montreal news. On today's episode, we'll be playing live audio taken from the discussion that occurred between the Divest McGill occupiers of the James Administration Building and Suzanne Fortier, the principal of McGill University, and also from the diploma returning ceremony that Divest McGill hosted, where various alumni returned their McGill diplomas because of the university's investment in fossil fuels. But first, headlines. At 10:15 a.m. on Tuesday, March 29th, 9 members of Divest McGill, a campus climate justice group, entered the James Administration Building through a back door and began a sit-in in the reception area outside Principal Suzanne Fortier's office. They remained there for 72 hours protesting the Board of Governors' recent decision not to divest its holdings from the fossil fuel industry. The Board of Governors voted against divestment on March 23rd during a closed session of a meeting outside its regular schedule. The agenda had not been publicized in advance, unlike its other meetings. The Board of Governors' decision followed the release of a report by its committee to advise on the matters of social responsibility, CAMSR, which claimed that climate change does not cause grave social injury, and that divestment was therefore unwarranted. On March 31st, the Sexual Assault Center of McGill Student Society, SACOMS, as part of its annual Sexual Assault Awareness Week, organized a demonstration in support of survivors as a response to the Gomeshi trial. Held in Community Square, the demonstration aimed to create a space to discuss the failure of the criminal justice system and the McGill administration to support survivors of sexual assault. The Student Society of McGill University, SMU, Legislative Council convened on March 31st for a supplementary meeting where they adopted a policy on Indigenous solidarity and discussed 5 other motions. Council also considered 12 notices of motion which will be brought back for debate at this week's council meeting on April 7th. These include motions regarding the proposed smoking on campus policy and accessibility policy, the service status of elections SMU, and the amendments for the internal regulations of the elections and referenda. Hundreds gathered at Norman Bethune Square at 6 p.m. on March 29th for 2 hours to peacefully show support and solidarity with the mobilization efforts of Black Lives Matter Toronto. The demonstration was met with no interference from the Service de Police de la Ville de Montréal, SPVM, although multiple police cars were stationed on site. Recent mobilization in Toronto has come about in response to the acquittal of the Toronto police officer, whose identity has not been released, responsible for the fatal shooting of Andrew Loku, a 45-year-old father of 5 experiencing a mental health crisis at the time. On July 5, 2015, Loku, a South Sudanese man, was holding a hammer when he was shot twice by police in his neighbor's home. For more in-depth coverage of the news stories, please visit mcgilldaily.com/news.
Excuse the news. This is a McGill Daily and CKUT collaboration.
The following audio excerpts we'll be hearing were taken from the live stream taken by the McGill Daily News team. The first that we'll be hearing is a discussion between Divest McGill occupiers and Suzanne Fortier, the principal of McGill University. The sit-in campaign was called Hashtag Our Future, Our Choice, and it was calling for the following 3 demands. 1, to hold public hearings on the CAMSR report, as well as educational events such as panels and roundtables on divestment and climate change promoted by the university. 2, to publicly disclose any and all expert testimony gathered throughout their investigation. 3. Principal Fortier must make a statement acknowledging that the activities of fossil fuel corporations cause grave social harm through the exacerbation of climate change and the devastating impacts on the frontline communities.
So what's the intent then? The intent in many ways is to make a political action, and I know that you have said, and I know that you have said the university is not a political actor.
That's
you quoted Harvard and say that. But I don't know how you claim to be a leader in sustainability, deny all political involvement. Universities have a political impact. That's why you have pictures of you taking hands with Stephen Harper in your reception area. That's why you've met with Justin Trudeau. Universities have political impact, and to deny that we are a political actor is entirely false. Why did we divest from tobacco? Why did we divest from South African apartheid? It is because those are political statements that by using our power as an institution for higher learning, we can have a serious impact for good.
Yes.
So I don't understand how you can deny the university's role as a political actor. I don't understand.
Well, I mean, universities have taken a role as political actor very, very clear. And in very clear area was there was clear consensus. I did that in my first week at McGill. You may not know that. You might not have been here. But I stood up after a few days at McGill to say that this university was not in favor of the charter of value, that le projet de loi de la province du Québec. And I did that because there was consensus on the campus. I did check that there was consensus by reaching out to every leader in this community, even though I just arrived. And I was able to do that.
And that's great.
But that is an extreme case here, where there was clear consensus and issue was very straightforward for this community, and that's why we reached consensus.
Okay.
It's rare. It's rare that we have such... If you think of tobacco, you know, you'd have difficulty to find positive impact of the use of tobacco.
Yeah, I think...
But if you think of fossil fuel, well, you know, there's been... We now realize, of course, that there are very serious negative impacts. But it's done a lot of good initially, certainly, and we all have benefited from that. Now we say, oh, wait a minute, we didn't realize that part. Now we better take action, and we are. But it's not an area where you'd say there's a clear
consensus.
No,
perhaps I would disagree.
There's a clear consensus on the urgency to an orderly transition, I believe. Well, maybe not on orderly. There's a clear consensus on a transition.
Yeah, the word that we would use at the Divest McGill is a transition, one that prioritizes Indigenous rights, allows workers to continue working, etc.
Yeah.
That's something that we've been advocating for, and I think that it's very clear in our messaging that fossil fuel divestment isn't about getting off fossil fuels tomorrow. It's about taking away the social license for fossil fuel companies to operate with impunity. That has always been our message and what we're saying today.
Yeah.
But I have a very clear question for you, actually, because let's not talk about whether or not we agree on climate change, whether fossil fuels do good or bad. Let's talk about what's in the report specifically and on statement of social injury. So you're saying you won't make this statement because the report says it all. Will you acknowledge that failure to obtain Indigenous consent violates the enforcement of rules of domestic or international laws against the deprivation of health, safety, or basic freedoms?
I'm not going to say yes or no, because I don't say yes or no to questions like this. I would study more deeply before I say yes or no. I'll go back, review the facts and all that. I'm not going to say yes or no on the spot here.
Okay, but that would be something you would be considering perhaps maybe in the next couple hours. You could go.
I won't commit to that. I have other things in my day that are scheduled, so I'm not going to leave this meeting and hit all of the reports and do the due diligence that I feel would be required for me to answer your question. So
could you commit to preparing a response to that question and making that response public within a given time frame?
I think it's, I'd have to think about it, you know. It's a bit of a trick question, frankly. I'm not sure that I've committed to that yet. I mean, you know, these questions are not simple. I mean, we'd all like to live in a world where the questions are simple and the answers are yes or no. But frankly, that is not often the case. And certainly have good heads and good people, good scholars in this area that I would certainly want to hear from.
We
you
also
know, these are not simple questions.
We also have over 200 indigenous
So if
students.
You ask me yes or no questions,
I
can tell you yes or no on certain things, but on many things, I would tell you yes or no on the spot.
I felt like that was a very clear question. You are not answering
the question is clear, but
it is
complex.
Yeah. So the question itself
is complex.
Is the failure to obtain Indigenous consent a violation of the enforcement of rules of domestic or international laws against the deprivation of health, safety, or basic freedoms?
You think that's simple?
Yes.
I don't.
I think my answer is yes. Mm-hmm. But that's a violation.
No, you think your question is simple?
I think that
I think the answer is simple to a lot of people.
Because violating consent of anyone is depriving of their rights.
Well, it depends. You know, it depends on what the treaties are. It depends on what the agreements have been. It depends on a lot of things. I have to know that before I answer your question. I'm not going to answer it. He's the political scientist expert.
Well,
but
would
you
answer
that question on spot?
No,
I
don't know enough about the details of the question to be able to answer it on the spot. So.
Yeah,
I feel like these are the sorts of questions that Kamsa should go through before finalizing a vote. You know, this would have been a very relevant thing for everybody on the Board of Governors to research before they had their vote.
You know, you say you don't like to make complex decisions right on the spot, but you gave the Board of Governors 26 hours to read through this report, which has a lot of implications in it. It has a lot of particularly troubling statements. And I think that this is one of the strongest examples for how... I'm actually quite honestly appalled that this is not something that was considered. This is an answer you cannot give me because you say you don't have enough information. How was that not considered before you released the Kamsa report? You're on Kamsa, yes?
Yes, I am. Yes.
So how was that not considered when it was clearly in our research brief?
Yes. Yeah. And I think we discussed it, but, you know, you're asking me out of memory here to go back? No, I cannot tell you. No.
Would you say that that is a problem with the Kamsa report?
No, I don't so. Because, you know, when you look at issues that are that complex, of course, you know, you can pick at every single little details in everything. And, we'd still be studying the report. At one point, I think you've come to what you think is the right direction, and you have to make a recommendation, and you do. Now, of course, you can... On peut l'éplucher en petits morceaux, okay? And that, you know, you're asking... Should we go back and do that? I don't think so. I think it's time for us to move on and to take concrete actions. I think I'm going to come back to that. The actions that have been recommended by Kamsa are concrete actions that have, I think, that have a real impact. And one action that you favor, and I respect that, Kamsa did not believe it would have a real impact, did not believe it was the appropriate action to take at this time.
We're not talking about divestment right now. We're
I know, but I'm saying
injury.
That, you know, we're talking about what the recommendations are, which are to take concrete actions.
Yeah.
That's what is happening.
We're not talking about the recommendations right now. We're talking about social injury itself. That's what our demand
is.
And I don't think that Indigenous students on campus are going to be satisfied with, or Indigenous community members, Indigenous people in this province are going to be satisfied with the principal McGill saying that's just a small detail, we can't go over anything. When that
I didn't say it was just a small detail, but
great,
I'm saying
the
to
most
you
great
that
impact of the fossil fuel industry that has been blatantly ignored in this report.
I'm saying that it is a very complex question that you ask. You're making an assertion and you're asking me to say yes or no, and I'm saying I can't do that on the spot.
You just finished hearing the confrontation between the occupiers, one of the voices being Emily Boyting, the SMU VP External and a member of Divest McGill, and Suzanne Fortier, the principal of McGill University. The next audio clip was also taken part of the live stream, taken at the diploma returning ceremony, where alumni came to return their diplomas because of McGill University's ongoing investment in fossil fuels. The speaker, Nagme Sebet Resik, a financial consultant for Scotiabank, talks about a client who recently came to her to ask her to manage a $2 million donation to McGill and the client's reason for withdrawing that donation.
And look, I thought we will have a hat. Who would keep this? It's from 1988, when I graduated. I have a message to two individuals today. And thank you for being here to hear. His Excellency, the Right Honorable David Justin, the Governor General of Canada. I received this from your hands when you were the principal of McGill. Come and see what has happened to McGill, what it has been reduced to. I'm sorry to give this back. However, there are people you are sending to Paris. The head states are going there. I don't think McGill knows why they were there. I graduated from biochemistry. And if they need some research on what the effects of fossil fuel is and what it can do, I'd be happy to forward some research to McGill. But if they like maybe read newspapers, pick up a newspaper. Or yesterday, was it CBC was covering the life of Margie Wood at McMurray? Ask her if her life has been touched. The CBC cover, I don't know. Do you watch TV? But this message now is for Madame Fourier. I graduated from biochemistry, went on to work in a pharmaceutical company. Long story make short, I ended up in the financial industry, and now I am a portfolio manager at the Scotiabank. It gets better. Listen to this. A client of mine last year approached me, like many have done in the past. I would like to donate $2 million to McGill. I said, that's wonderful. I have a special space in McGill for me, in my heart for McGill. We called McGill. We met with the specific department to receive the $2 million. Although the client said, I would rather you manage it and just send the returns, because I've heard their endowment funds have been going down because of some bad investments. I said, I'd invest their endowment fund, although I'd be happy to advise them, free of charge. Yeah. But we had meetings, and the meetings went on seriously until we to the point that we were ready to sign documents, and a representative of the department, which we met with, is here. I'm not going to name names, and I will keep my client's identity anonymous, as is his wish. However, when we received the famous email from you, Madame Fortier, as an alumni received, I informed my client, and we are very sorry to say we are not going to contribute the $2 million to McGill anymore. Yeah! Unless you reverse your decision. Listen, I know that this decision was not done out of ignorance. God, I hope it wasn't. This is an educational institution, after all. I think it is being done because of irresponsibility. What cause you are serving, which lobby you are protecting, I don't know. But I know one thing, being the financial industry. Funds that will not come to McGill will hurt. And if I advised one client not to do this, I'm sorry to tell you, I have many clients and millions of dollars under my management. We don't speak loudly. I'm so sorry taking from your time, but allow me, indulge me. We do not speak loudly. We do not occupy buildings as these courageous people do. We speak a language that you will understand very soon. Here you go, Madame Fortier.
Finish hearing from different excerpts from the live stream that occurred during Divest McGill's 3-day occupation of the James Administration Building and the diploma returning ceremony. To watch the full live stream and various other videos, please visit vimeo.com/McGillDaily. That does it for this edition of Unfit to Print on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is the final episode of the term, and we will be returning in September. In the meantime, check out our previous coverage and podcasts on mcgilldaily.com/podcast. You can also pick up the final print issue of the year on stands.